Thank you very much. Where I come from, in Berlin, Mass., the people in AA call me John the Indian. I really don't believe that's the reason why I am an alcoholic, although I still have a reservation. It's good to be here. I was sitting there and telling my wife, Kathy, a lot of people here. And it gives you a funny feeling when you know that you have to get up here and speak. And it kind of brings me back in the early days when I was new in the program. If someone had told me that I would ever get up and speak in an AA meeting, I would have never believed. Probably because I brought a very unhealthy attitude to this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I arrived here, I was almost 30 years old. And I've been away from my reservation since at the age of 14. My father, well, he liked to drink, and when he died, he had a half a gallon jug under his bed. And 5 years later, we lost 8 members in our family. When I was 13, my mother died, and when I was 14, I left home. I really didn't know where I was going, but the Indians in reservation talked about lumber camps in Maine. And sometimes later, I arrived in CC camp in Maine, where I stayed for 4 years washing dishes. The man who was in charge suggested one day that I should leave and join the younger people. So I went to Quebec City, and I joined the Canadian Infantry, where I stayed 3 years and a half washing more damn dishes. I took a drink the day I got my discharge, and for the next 7 years, I live in a skid row. And here I was, in an AA meeting when I was almost 30 years old. I have never been married. Never owned a car, couldn't read and write. I had a long hair, and I had wine sores. Can you imagine if someone had told me then that if I should stay sober, one day I would speak in Kentucky? On the other hand, if you see me laying in a gutter with long hair and a wine sores, you would never stop and say, now there lies a perfectionist. I mean, you're not that smart. We talk about so many things today, and I, for one, who is fortunate that I have been able to identify the speakers from all walks of life, have given me a message. I have been touched. And without question, I will leave you much richer in spirit than when I have arrived here. Probably among many gifts that I have received, that as I stand here, I am still the same person that I was when I arrived here. Things that I was so ashamed of has not really changed. I thought I will never get up and speak because I didn't talk good English. And I didn't for 2 years. And then I wasn't going to speak because I couldn't read and write. I couldn't understand what people in AA were trying to tell me. I remember my first meeting. A fella, another Indian guy, I have once met in Tupper Lake, New York. I was hitchhiking, and I walked into the bar room. He came to me, and he said that he knew my father. I, myself, have not met him before. He brought me to his home that night. I met his wife. She was a nurse, and gave me a ride on his new Ford. But Ike became an alcoholic, and he wound up in Salvation Army in Syracuse, New York. Started to attend an AA meeting and find out sometimes later that I was sober. And I was in a mission. He walked in one night and he asked me if I wished to attend an AA meeting. At first I said no because I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. Although I was sitting there with long hair and wine sword. But Ike says, well, you know, they have coffee and donuts and they're free. And that's what kind of touched me when I first arrived here. You know, I was telling Kathy, I don't think I have ever stayed such a beautiful hotel. We got upstairs and there was a basket of fruit. And that was touching. But what really touched me was Gene when he told me, John, from now on, when you eat, all you have to do is sign your name on a check. You know, I liked him right away. I thought they were very compassionate. And I never had trouble to have a compassion, especially with the expense of somebody else. But I came to AA, and as I was walking through the doors of AA, there was a man. He became a good friend. He was a lawyer. He was sober 13 years, and his job every night was to greet the people who attend that meeting. He gave me a coffee, and I sat down. And my first speaker I've heard in AA was a lady judge. And she was telling me, please try to identify. And now, can you imagine me identifying with a lady judge? And it isn't that I have never met a judge before. I met one particular judge for 43 times, and never once did he suggest that I should try to identify. Last time I met him, I thought it was very touching. He called me by my first name before he gave me 6 months. And when we talk about the grace of God, and we talk about God moving in mysterious ways, the best thing I can say that I have been sober ever since. So you might say that what touched me on my first meeting, it was something much greater than the words could have given me about the nature of my sickness. And God knows one who lives in the street for 7 years, he walks with plenty of evidence to have convinced anyone that I am one should never take a drink. But I have learned since then that my sickness doesn't allow me to see the truth, nor does it allow me to accept. There are many who come to see us today. Some arrive here with degrees. Some who wear Roman collar. Some are teachers. And they have the same problem as I did, because they have the same sickness, and sickness tells them the same thing. We sober up and we look back and we can say, my God, I was an alcoholic 10 years ago. I look back in my life, I feel it is very healthy for me, because in my education in AA, it has allowed me to see much that I know I have passed by for many years in my life. Someone said once that a man is a rational man and he must function with intellect. He must have purpose and direction. But like someone said today, that comes by being responsible for your own footsteps. And when I arrived in AA, if you ask anything about me, I would have told lies, because I was ashamed of it. I would have never believed that my greatest task in life would be to accept the truth, because the truth is something that I didn't like. But my education in AA has allowed me to see myself with a different light. You know, I always look back, and I know that my boss in lumber camp felt that I should leave and join the younger people, because I was living there with older people. Everybody was joining the service. And he said to me, it would be good for you. And I agree. I never knew that I was a type of a person who never could belong anyplace. I felt unworthy. I lived in a dream. I remember when I lived in an old empty house in a reservation for 1 year. My family died with TB. And I couldn't get a home because most people felt that I too had TB. So I live in an old empty house with a dog. And I come home, but there was no lights and there was no heat. It was a vacant house. And I would crawl between two mattresses and I would dream. One day, I will live in a big house. I will have a big job. And I will have nice clothes and big car and a nice girl. And people will look up to me. And I will lose this feeling that I have. I don't know whether this is an attitude of an alcoholic or a desperate person. I look back and I can see that having these things were some quality. What I could not see, that ingredient that nourishes the hunger comes not because you live in a big house or because you have a nice girl or because people look up to you or because you have a big job. So you might say that my attitude towards life, it was all wrong from the start. And when I joined the Canadian Infantry, and when they told me that I have to wash dishes because I couldn't read and write, I felt unworthy. I was ashamed of it. I felt less than other people. And instead of taking the pass to go home and show my people that I had a uniform, I didn't. Because I was ashamed that they might find out that I was washing dishes. I couldn't even go out with a girl. And I was old enough to know that I should go out with a girl. You don't learn everything in school. They say God moves in mysterious ways. I knew that. One of the nicest things happened in my life when I took a drink. Because when I drank, alcohol took away those things that robbed me when I was sober. You know, you don't have to be too smart to know that you're free. That you can talk to somebody without being sensitive that you might find out that you wash dishes or you don't talk good English. When I drank, that's what booze gave me, freedom. I went out with a girl the first night I got drunk. And I didn't get up in the morning and say, Christ, this will kill me. You know? I didn't have that problem. If someone had told me that night, John, if you continue on drinking, that you will live in the Skid Row for 7 years, I would have never believed. All I know that I have found a friend. But because I am an alcoholic, and because I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and because I have been taught something about the nature of my sickness, I look back and take a second look, and I can see what else happened the night I took my first drink, simply because I have never been a social drinker. On one hand, that booze gave me a freedom that I have always sought. On another, it started to rob me right away. I can identify the words people, or he talks about when he says that it is cunning, it's baffling, and it is powerful. Without help, it's too much for us. Alcohol will take away those things that you'll never believe would happen. And it doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter who your parents was. It doesn't matter whether you wear a Roman collar. Slowly but surely, the booze will remove those things that you've been taught by your parents, by your instructors, and one day you wake up and you don't remember how you arrived there. That was the first thing I identified with the speaker. 2 years later, Mies was a lady judge who spoke almost every meeting you go to simply because she had a talent in putting the words together and put them in its proper place. And every meeting you go, somebody called me, and she would stand there and she would talk about her father being a judge and her husband as a doctor, and she would use the words, you know, that I couldn't understand what in the hell she was talking about. I memorized a lot of things in AA in the early days that I didn't know what they meant. She used to say that it's a mental obsession that precedes the first drink. Never heard it before. I mean, the people I travel with in the street, I have never heard anyone say, John, you're way ahead of me. Somebody else been listening to my tape. I will not tell that story. I have never heard anyone say, John, don't you know it's a mental obsession that precedes the first drink, and once you take a drink now, it's coupled with a physical compulsion. Holy Christ, you know, even if you're sober, it's difficult to understand. Probably one of the greatest things that happened to me since I've been sober, this lady, she was an Al-Anon lady, came to me a couple of weeks ago and she said, John, I have to tell you something. She said, my husband came home the other night, she said, and he runs right to a dictionary, and she said to him, what's wrong? He said, John the Indian said something tonight and I have to look it up. And you know, it feels good to know that there's another stupid bastard somewhere. No offense, Emerson, I didn't mean to say that. I'm sitting there night after night, and of course I admire this lady, so is everybody else. But one night, and I guess this is what it means when it says we come to and we come to believe. And I was sitting there one night, and somebody asked her to speak, and I knew her story by heart. Except this time, instead of her story that deprived me from the spirit of belong, it touched me. She said that she used to wake up in wall-to-wall carpet in the morning, and she never remembered how she got there. She always said that. But then I could see that I woke up in sidewalk every morning and I didn't remember how I got there. Then she said, I was so sick that I couldn't walk, so I would crawl to a John. Well, I can identify with that. She said when she got there, she didn't use the John the way it was designed. She stick her head in there like she was looking for serial numbers. And of course, I do the same thing, except I crawl in the back of the building. The thing that really touched me when she said, when I finish puking, And I don't know, this is the only place you can come and talk about puking. I spoke in Westchester County one time in New York, and even Alkis are rich over there. And I never seen so many women wear so much jewelry. And I was talking about puking, and this older lady in front with a lot of jewelry was going like this. She finally caught herself, and she got scared. And I said to her, don't worry about it. In AA, we identify that as a spiritual ingredient. She said, when I finished puking, the first thing that came to her mind, I have to have a drink. Now, you have two people. One, of course, is a judge who lives in a big house. Society thinks that she is something special, and she is. And you have an Indian who lives in a sidewalk who cannot read and write, and society doesn't think that he's too special. One day, they both wake up in the morning, not remembering how they arrived. They both crawl. And when they arrive at their destination, they both puke their guts out. When they both finish puking, they both said the same thing, because they're both alcoholic. And when they arrive in AA, the spirit, the law of God that allows you and I to see each other as one people don't change, because she's a judge and because I am a bum. It was easy to make a joke with my friend Emerson tonight, because we both understand that God is more generous than most people. I could identify because I came back. I came back. And I started to see things that I never could understand before. But I couldn't in my drinking days. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I tried to stop drinking. There were times when the boys in skits, they suggested, John, why don't you stop drinking? You look sick. And when the boys in the skit tell you, you look sick, you're sick. And one of them said to me one time, John, why don't you take a bleach like I did? And he was sitting there with long hair, and I said to him, does it really work? He said, yes. So I was so sick, one time I went to see a priest. And I told him that I wished to take a pledge for 1 year. And you know, you have to be sick wanting to take a pledge for 1 year. But priest, I guess the way I smelled didn't help any. He said to me, why don't you take it for 30 days? And if you are to be successful, come back. But I listened to a speaker one night. He said he took a pledge, and he lasted 300 yards. And I can identify with that. I remember Tom in a rescue mission. Tom was a nice man. Tom always took an interest in me. As a matter of fact, one time he gave me a private room in rescue mission. And when you have a private room in rescue mission, you have class. He says to me one day, there's a fellow by the name of Billy Graham coming to this city. He's a man who helps an awful lot of people. Would you go and listen to him every night? He will help you. And I did. I did, because my attitude about what I should be never changed. I have always felt if I could have these things, I would be a different person. And that's what I wanted in life. So I went to listen to Billy Graham. I did for 28. I think I was sober for 28 nights. Oftentimes I said, if Billy Graham stayed for 1 year, I would have been sober for 1 year. But he left and I got drunk. And a week later, Judge Darcy gave me 6 months in Jimmyville. And I said, I will never listen to Billy Graham again. The last time when I wanted help, I was in a mission. I was attending services, because if you attend services, Tom would give you a bed. While I was sitting there, a fella get up, all dressed up. He said that for many years, he was a bum just like us. And it's an awful statement to make anyway. But he said he accepted Christ as his personal savior, and since then, he got married, got himself a job, bought a new station wagon, and he said, you boys can do the same thing, and of course he touched me. And he said, all you have to do is move forward and accept Christ as your personal savior, and you'll be all right. Well, I didn't thought that was so hard to do. So I get up and I move forward. Not because I understood Christ he was talking about. I have never heard anyone talking about Christ. I spent 4 years in lumber camp, and I used to listen to lumberjacks talking about him. And by the time they finished with him, you wouldn't believe him either. But this guy, he put his arms around me, and he whispered here, and he said, son, you're saved. Well, you should see me the next morning. I'm facing a judge. And he didn't look to me like if I was saved. He's got my record. He looks at me and he said, don't you know, he said, the Fayette Park, it's for the decent people to go there on Sundays and not for a bums like you. Then he says, your Indians are all alike, he says. You come to this city, you get a job, you work for 1 week, you get drunk, and you get into a fight, he says to me. You always get into a fight. And he took his glasses off, and he gave me 6 months in Jimmyville. And I said to myself, this guy, he don't like Indians. Because he was bald-headed. Grandfather got to him first before I did. And I think all of us, in our own way, we certainly search. Because I'm not the type of person, you know, who likes to sleep in a sidewalk. But I did. I'm not the type of person who is built to bum. But I did. I paid a price, and I never believed I would. But I did. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. And when I came to AA, I didn't know that I was suffering from what we call physical, mental, and spiritual sickness. I listened to 3 speakers. One of them was Lady Judge, and I was ready to leave, and I was, when this lawyer came to me again, and he put his arms around me. He says to me, I have some friends, and I want you to meet. And people in AA worked very hard trying to convince me that I belonged here, and I knew it. And I think what brought me back to AA is simply because people asked me and wanted me to come back. I liked the way I was treated. I liked the respect I received here. I liked the understanding, and I suppose it was also love. We are told that it is not a spare part, but it is a human need. And perhaps I was touched in many ways. I came back simply because I wanted more of what I have received here. Sometimes later, one night, I was in the central group when Pat walked in. He says, John, I'm your sponsor. Well, Pat I knew before. Pat has been living in the Skid Row longer than I have. Pat is a man that you never trust drunk or sober. He was a college man. He was the dirtiest drunk you'll never see. He would steal your shoes and sell them and buy you a drink and say, no hard feelings. But Pat was a very unusual person. We all wound up with Major Harvey in Salvation Army sooner or later, you know, because someone got up one night and said, it doesn't matter whether you like to stop drinking or not. The body can only take so much. One day you have to stop because the body don't take it anymore. I can identify with that. We all wound up with Major Harvey in Salvation Army, and Pat was a very unusual person. You know, he gets sober, and he would go downstairs, and he would pick up the best suit that you can find. Well, he knew suits. You know, he had brains. And he's a perfectionist. He had a round hat and white shoes. And very, very classy when he's sober. Then he would go downstairs and pick the books, you know, just pile the books. And, you know, the books that he read, you couldn't even pronounce. then Major Harvey would give him a job in the office and he wouldn't look at you. You know, as far as he was concerned, you're the bum, and he was an executive. And I haven't seen Pat for a long time. You walked into a central group one night. He was all dressed up with a round hat and white shoes and a blonde. He walks right over to me and he says, I'm your sponsor. Then he whispers to me, he said, John, I have a new car outside. I will bring you home. And you know, it's like a godsend. Because people in AA wanted to give me a ride home and I wouldn't take it because I didn't want anybody to know that I'm in a rescue mission. I'm supposed to pay 35 cents a night and I'm behind 3 weeks' rent. I mean, I got financial problems. And I will never forget, one night, Pat stopped the car, myself, his girlfriend, he walks out in the car in Salvation, in Mission. He says to me, John, I know you're serious here, but you have to leave the Mission. You can't practice this program and live with those bums. And that's quite a statement, really, because I have never been able to identify with anybody else except those who had nothing. And you know, I wasn't about ready to leave the Mission. But I guess God was on his side because the damn place burned down one night. And 3 o'clock in the morning, I went to see Pat and I said to him, Rescue Mission burned down. And he said, that's the grace of God. And next morning, he brought me to a 12-step house, and I got a job. And I paid $7.50 a week and a bed. And my job was to wash and wax floors and answer to the telephone and make coffee and wash dishes. And I think one of my, well, among many French benefits that I have received in the program, not only that I have been able to live like a white man, dollar down and dollar a week, but I bought me a dishwasher. I steal a great kick out of it every day. I push the button and it hums, and I said, hum, you cheap bat. Well, I said, that.
Some smoke signals middle tonight. But I got thrown out of there about a year later. There were people who came to that place and play cards every night. And one day a girl by the name of Ann called and she wanted help. Of course I didn't have a car and I told her who she was and they told me that she's been around for a long time. And all she wants to do is use people in AA. And of course, I never understood the language then, no more than I do today. But I was sick and I was young in the program. I like what Father Martin said. He said, a man is a rational man and he must function with intellect. You must survive with your head. The program is believing, not so much a feeling. And of course, I didn't know anything about it. So I settled the argument like I've settled all the arguments. I upset the table while they were playing cards, and I punched one of them in his nose. And they threw me out, and here I was, walking down the Fayette Street. No home, no job. But they were good enough to call my sponsor, and he picked me up, and he brought me to his home. And next day, he brought me to Salvation Army. They gave me a job. Major Harvey gave me a job for $1 a week, where I lived for a year and a half. And I started to travel. When I was sober 5 years, I was 35 years old. I was living in a skid row. I look back and, you know, I don't think that I missed one meeting in those 5 years. Not that I really knew that AA would changed my life. Certainly I would never believe that I left a 15-room house. And Kathy and I, we met in AA 16 years ago. We got married, and because we're both compulsive, we now have 6 children. Unlike Emerson, I did my work. I didn't get bow-legged by riding ponies, I tell you that. They say that's a God's law, too. But I was lost. I was 35 years old, and you know, I left home at the age of 14. I didn't know where I was going. I was hitchhiking when I was sober 5 years, 1 o'clock in the morning. I never knew where I was going. I was lost. But I came to meetings every night, and I couldn't be honest. And Mary Ann talks about it. Every speaker talk about letting go of so many things about me. I just could not let go. I didn't want people to know where I come from. I didn't want anybody to know what was inside. I had this trained personality of mine to respond quickly, to tell you what I thought you wished to know. I know today that one who seeks to be that in life in which he is not, deprive himself from the truth of oneself. And the truth, it's the only quality for a human being, and there is no substitute. No man can walk with feeling of worthiness or the spirit of independence on one hand and tell lies about himself on the other. But I didn't know the difference. I lived for a meeting in Central Group, where I have first attended a meeting. Every 6 months they elected a new coffee maker, and I wouldn't give them the keys because I was stealing their donuts and I was sleeping there sometimes, and I needed a place, but I couldn't tell anybody. I looked for a meeting because I felt that it's the only time that I felt I was something in AA meeting, and I have learned today that you really don't have to be anything in AA to be something. As a matter of fact, we go out of our way, try to suggest those who come to us to forget that you're a teacher. Forget your color. Forget your name and your money. Forget all these things because AA works best in believing, in trusting. But I didn't know that. 1 o'clock, I arrived in a strange town in Barbaro, Mass. I find a men's room in a hotel, and there I stayed overnight. Barbaro has been a turning point in my life. I remember a couple of mornings later, I was having a little lunch in this restaurant owned by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, when a waiter asked me if I knew of any contractor in town that could remodel and paint her house. I said, I do. Me. She said, well, I didn't thought that you're a contractor. Well, I said, I didn't either. She said, could you come over and give me an estimate on my house? Which I did. I gave her an estimate for $300, and I got a job only because other contractors wanted $1,200 to $1,400. I got the job, and I went to see Paul. I said, I got the job, but I don't have any money. He says, why don't you go back and ask Rita? She might give you enough money to start your business. She gave me $100. So I went out, and I bought a coveralls because I felt, if you're going to be a president in your own company, you might as well buy a white coverall. I learned that in AA. So I bought white coveralls, I bought some paint and a hammer, drop cloths, and I carried everything to the job. Then I met a member of AA who worked in a telephone company, and I borrowed a 60-foot ladder, although it was against the law. Then I met another guy in there who had a truck, so him and I delivered it. And I got this big, huge ladder up there, and you know, this house was so big that I couldn't reach the peak. So I find some old lumber under the porch, and I carried it up there. And I built a scaffold right on top of the 60-foot ladder. And that's where I started my business, right close to heaven. And people were looking up for change. But thank God for a Paul who owned a restaurant, I didn't starve. My next house, I met the plumber in AA. Said, John, I have a ranch house in Hudson, which is only 7 miles. All you need, he said, is a 10-foot stepladder. So I borrowed a 10-foot stepladder. And I got all my drop cloths together and my white coveralls and my paint. And I stood in the corner and I stopped the bus. This guy stopped and he looks at me and he looks at my ladder. He says, you're not serious. I said, I am. I'm self-employed and I have no other means of getting to work. This guy must have been an alky, I guess. He says to me, if I give you a ride, would you promise you'll never do it again? My next house was the school teacher. She taught school for 40 years and she retired. I said to her one night, or afternoon, you think you could teach me how to read and write? 35 years old. She says, I've taught thousands of people how to read and write. Come tonight, she said. I said to her, I want a driving license. I got a book that had 69 questions. And someone said that I had to memorize these things to get a license. So I went to see her every night, and 3 months later, she helped me to memorize the 69 questions. So I took the test, and I passed. And here I am in my 5th year of sobriety, president in my own company, and I have a driving license. And I will never forget this lady. The night I went to see her, to thank her, she liked me because she only had one boyfriend in her lifetime, and his name was John. I used to call her up and say, this is John, and you say, oh, Johnny. That she liked me, and I remember we stood at the door, and she's holding my hands, and, you know, she had a little tears in her eyes, and she was trying to tell me that I should really consider continue on my education because my mind was so good. Again, I look back in my life, people like her. You know, I couldn't believe her. And so often today that I listen to speakers and I can identify one thing so clearly in my life, this business of letting go. Just let go. Or what AA says, let God be teachable. Our trust is believing. Faith is believing. And this is in the second step. And he says that it's the key that opens the door. Faith is the spirit of independence. Faith is the courage of a man's conviction. Faith, it's an identity. It's an ingredient that it is essential to serve. One God of understanding. Faith. I didn't know what it was. How could I have a good mind? I left home when I was 14. I washed dishes, 4 years in lumber camp, 3.5 years in the Canadian Army. I have never been married. Never owned a car. Lived in the Skid Row for 7 years. Not too long ago, I was sleeping in a men's room in a hotel, and she's trying to tell me that I have a good mind. Quite a challenge. But you know, in some ways, she was right. I remember once I was hired by the government. I was a director for 3 reservations in the state of Maine. Kathy and I moved to Maine. I took off my dirty old coveralls and I put on a tie. While I was working, I received a call from the University of Maine. They wanted me to teach in the adult education program for $50 an hour. I went there, and I was so impressed of what I said, I gave them half an hour free. And on my way home, I remember my dear friend's school teacher one night when she had tears in her eyes, trying to tell me, "John, you know, your past is lousy, but your mind is okay." And I was trying to convince her that my mind couldn't be okay because my past was so lousy. And she was trying to tell me that past has nothing to do in believing. You just simply exercise what God gave you already, a right to choose for your own life. But I didn't know that either. And so, my life changed. I remember sometimes later, Paul, who owned the restaurant, came to see me, and he had 11 passenger station wagon, and he said, "John, you can buy this car for $750. I said, "But I don't have the money." He said, "Why don't you ask the lady upstairs, and she'll give you enough money for the down payment?" And I did, and I bought my first car, 11 passengers. So here I was in my fifth year sobriety, president in my own company. I had a driving license, and I had a car, and I said to myself, now maybe I should find me a girlfriend. But I have this 4 teeth in front missing, and I felt that no one can find a decent girl with 4 teeth in front missing. And that's the only thing I've lost in drinking. And it's funny, you know, I like to tell you how I lost. Since the only thing I've lost in drinking, I'll tell you. You know, in Syracuse, New York, there is a place called Slave Market where all the bums go there and get a job, and you get paid right away. But also in Syracuse, New York, there is a place called Smitty's where all the New York Indians drink in Smitty's. I don't drink in Smitty's because I'm a Mi'kmaq Indian. And New York Indians and Mi'kmaq Indians don't communicate too well. And every once in a while, 20 of us Mi'kmaqs would get drunk, then we go to Smitty's. And we'll communicate. So, I just finished my job getting from Slave Market Saturday afternoon. I had unloaded a boxcar with a brick, and I had leather gloves on, and I was drinking, and I was strong, and I was walking right. I had no intention of going to Smitty's because I'm not that crazy. But while, as I was walking by, someone opened the door and threw this guy out, and that's where I met Smiley. Smiley is a little bit of an Irishman with a degree. He weighs about 90 pounds. So I pick him up, and I said to him, "What in the hell's wrong with you?" Well, he said, "It's those Indians inside." Well, I said, "They can't do that to you." And Smiley said, "No, they can't." I said, "What do you say you and I go in there and clean them up?" Smiley says to me, "You know, it's a good idea." Well, by the Jesus, it wasn't a good idea. I woke up in General Hospital, and I lost 4 teeth. And Smiley said in there without a scratch. And, you know, the years went by, and, you know, I woke up in jail, and I'll be all messed up. And Smiley was sitting there without us, and he never dawned on me until one morning I said to him, "Smiley, how come that I can get so messed up and you never have a scratch?" He looks at me, he says, and he has the most honest face in the world. That's why he's such a good bum. He looks at me, he said, "John," he said, "don't you know I'm a college man?" But I met a dentist in AA. I've been watching him for about a month. And I cornered him one night, and I said to him, "I have a little problem, and I was wondering if you could help me." He said, "What's the problem?" Well, I said, "I'm looking for a girlfriend, and I have these 4 teeth in front missing, and I was wondering if you could put them back." He gave me his card, and he said, "Call my secretary," which I did, and I arrived there. And he opened my mouth, and this man, he wanted to pull 14 teeth. 14 teeth before he gave me 4. And I said to myself, this isn't a bargain at all. I said to him, "Well, how long that's going to take?" Well, he said, "If you keep your appointment, about 3 months." And you know, in AA, it's true. They say you get what you need and not what you want. But it was, you also, when you earn something, you appreciate. Because when I got my teeth that day, I was very happy. I rush back home, I run upstairs, I look in the mirror, and I laugh for 2 hours with a spirit of gratitude. I met Mary one night in an AA meeting, and she says to me, I'm told that you have a new car. I said, yes, 11 passengers. She said, I run a faith house, home of an alcoholic women. I'm looking for someone to bring the girls to a meeting. Would you like the job? I said, I'll be very happy to. So Thursday night, I picked the girls up, and that's where I met my wife, Kathy. On my way home, I said to her, how about a date? She said, no. And, of course, I got hurt because I'm a sensitive person, and I get hurt easily, and I don't suffer well. But, you know, AA would start working because on my way home, I said to myself, who in the hell she thinks she is? You know, she lives in a faith house. She's got nothing. And here I am. I'm president in my own company. I own my own car, new set of teeth. Who the hell needs her anyway? Thursday night came along, and I picked the girls up again, and on our way back, I said to her, how about a show in Boston Sunday? She said, yes. So we went to show in Boston, and on our way back, I asked her to marry me. She said, but I don't know you. So I said, that's all right. We still have 5 miles to go. We'll get acquainted. So we got married. And we stop our car and Marlboro, and we count our change. We had $85. We didn't really know where to go. We decided to go back home. 21 years has gone by. But that was a mistake. I don't know how so difficult for Alkis to look back. And it's so easy, someone will stand up and say, place principles above personality. Rise above your feelings. Believe in God. Pray for doing a God's will. I've heard those words many times. And I remember when I went back home, then a lot of those feelings came back because I had no spiritual support. And I remember something that touched me today that I long ago forget, that when a lady talks about her mother dying with dignity. My mother did, you know, and after my father died, of course we were poor. And my mother always thought that I was a very special person because she told me that she was proud. I never cried. And she would write a note and wrap it in my hand with a sweater. We need food, she said. See the Indian agent. 14 miles one way. And I took those trips. In those 5 years, I made many trips. And I had twin brothers who died in the same year, and they would cry all night. They would go blind, and my mother never gave up. She used to say, it's all right. We'll send John to an Indian agent tomorrow. We'll get food. And I will never forget the last time when she told me that she was dying, and she's been in bed for 2 years. She couldn't get up, and she wanted a jar of Vaseline. Would I like to see an Indian agent once again? I said, sure. I went to see him. I arrived there, and it was in winter. And I gave him a note. He looked at it and he threw it on the snow and shut the door in my face. And I remember something today that I think I'd forgotten since when I was a kid. My father sang in the church. He was always drunk, but he always sang in church. As a matter of fact, the only thing I remember is my father. He was sang in the church, and one day when they threw him out. When my mother died, just before she died, she asked me to see a man in a reservation who was singing in the church. She wanted him to come to our house and sing the hymn that my father always sang. And you know, I'm 52 years old, and it's the first time I remember the Al-Anon speaker talk about dignity, faith, unshakable. No matter what storms you face, this business of faith is just unshakable. I will never have that faith. And so, here I was, facing my past once again, and I don't have a support to forget it, and I run. Kathy and I left, and we arrived in Marlboro, and we had $35 left, and we moved into a three-room apartment, and we had absolutely nothing except the coffee table that was given to us from a fate house. And of course, even newlyweds cannot sleep in coffee tables, so we slept on a floor. But you can have a lot of fun on the floor, too. You thought I was getting spiritual, didn't you? I spoke in a meeting one night, and after the meeting, I talk about having fun on the floor, and this lady, I guess she was rich. She said to me, young man, she calls me young man, I don't know, she said, how much fun you can have on the floor, she said. But I know, he said, you can have a lot of fun on the Oriental rug. So I said, well, at least you identify. But we're laying on the floor, and I said to Kathy, you know, I would like to have a boy. Because I'm the only one left, and I like to have this name gone. And so Christmas came along, and my wife was in the hospital. And I went out, and I bought a couple of feathers for the boy. And I received a call, and she's crying. She said, honey, it's a girl. And I said, you must be kidding. Next Christmas came along, and she was in hospital again. Then I received a call, and she's still crying. She said, honey, it's a girl. But you know, they say experience is a great teacher. I knew that my wife loved me, and she wanted to give me a boy, so I went over and see her, and I said, don't worry about it. Just have an open mind, and we'll try again. Someone said that in AA. So next Christmas came along, and my wife was in there again. And I received a call, and she's still crying. This time it was twin boys. So I got scared. I went to see her, and I said, what'd you say that next Christmas we hang our stockings and wait for Santa Claus? Then the girl came along and the boy came along. And you know, we all have a lot to be grateful for. You know what I'm grateful for? My family have never been hungry. They fight in the morning what cereal they're going to have. But they don't cry because they have been hungry. One of my French benefits. Another thing, and I like to sit down with this. I think AA gives an awful lot to a lot of us. What it gives me is to be able to stand up in front of all these people. I know what kind of people you are. I know what kind of people who are sitting in a table. I'm not an educated man. I am an intelligent man. And yet, I just don't have this feeling of unworthiness anymore. I am not ashamed no more because of my past, because of the lack of education, or because I don't talk good English. I believe for all of us, Time comes for all of us when God chooses for you and for me to be a power of example for your fellow man. It is the greatest honor and the greatest reward that man will ever receive in life. For you can put all the minds together in the world, they will never even touch the greatness of God. One who wishes to do a God's will in this life, there is nothing that he meets that will make him feel unworthy. I remember a long time ago, I'll never forget, one night after I finished speaking, a young man came to see me and he put his arms around me. He said, "I have to ask you something. It's very important." And I find out he was a priest and totally disarmed me, because I could not let go. I couldn't say nothing. And I felt good, but I felt guilty. I felt bad. I went home. I learned from that experience. Today, it wouldn't bother me at all, simply because I would say to myself, whatever I do, it's a God's will. And it makes me feel good. Kathy and I, we wish to thank you for inviting us to be here, for your